What a difference a month makes. On election night, Democrats led only one of California's seven battleground congressional races. The next day, that crept up to two. And then, as the days and weeks flew by and counties kept counting ballots, that number kept climbing. Three, then four, then five, then six. And now, something not even most Democrats saw coming. All seven. Republicans are reeling, and in some cases, questioning how the ballots counted after Election Day could drive races so far to the left. Democrats are gleefully claiming validation for every chess move they made in these California campaigns over the last 2 years. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, it's the final episode of Keys to the House, our podcast on California's battleground congressional races. I'm your host, Ben Adler. Since California's election system is getting blamed for a lot these days, let's add one more burden to its shoulders, the long wait for this final podcast episode. We were holding out until all these races were resolved, and this is how long it took. So now we know the who, what, where, and when about these California House results, we can examine why and how Democrats swept Republicans out of office, with Republican political consultant Mike Madrid and Paul Mitchell of Political Data Incorporated. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Let's start with the final race to sort itself out, the Central Valley District that the Associated Press actually called on election night for Republican Congressman David Valadao of Hanford. He led by more than 7.5% at the time, more than 5,000 votes. But the AP uncalled that race last week when Democrat T.J. Cox overtook Valadao after chipping away at that lead day by day. And while the AP hasn't called the race for Cox yet, others have, including the Cook Political Report, and Cox is claiming victory. And I sure as heck didn't see this coming. Did either of you?
Not the Valadao race. There was, you know, on election night, like you said, that Cox was behind by 7 points. And generally what we do see is with these late ballots that tend to be more Democratic leaning in the votes, we usually see Democrats gaining about 2 points. And in this race, the Democrat actually gained 6 points, which was, you know, about three times more than we would have expected. And part of it has to do with just the fact that there were so many more late ballots in all of these races, particularly in these districts where they had huge field organization and huge, you know, ground campaigns to get these late voters to, you know, take their absentee ballots, drop them off at the polling place, or do provisional ballots, or make sure they mail them by election day and could be counted in those days after the election.
And so, Paul, you didn't see it coming. Mike, did you?
Did not see it coming. And to me, the Valadao state's really kind of the most fascinating seat of all of these. And we talked about this a little bit previously in the series. The Valadao seat really does meet all of the criteria of being really kind of one of those red districts where the whole country is either blue becoming bluer or red becoming redder. And here, there's a significant and sizable Latino community, and that's always what has been the tantalizing shiny object for Democrats looking at this seat and always falling not just short but far short of expectations to get this. The reason really is because a lot of these areas that are rural are white, have a strong white conservative constituency, and voted, you know, and vote rather conservatively. Seem to be getting redder, at least in most parts of the country. They have been trending that way. And I think the fact that Valadao lost, presuming he will, and I think he will, is just a sign of how deep what this change, this break in the Republican coalition is, which I don't think a lot of people are talking about yet. We're going to get into some of the significant reasons of what happened with the House. But one of those really important pieces, I think, is that break in the Republican coalition.
In our last episode, which we taped 2 days after the election when we were all half asleep and which, like a lot of analysis around that time, did not age well. And Paul, you've given me a bit of a hard time for this. I was saying, so why didn't Democrats, instead of investing all this money in races like Devin Nunes elsewhere in the Central Valley or Tom McClintock up here in the Sacramento area, put all the money into finding another 5,000 voters in Valadao's district? And it turns out they did, apparently. So how were Democrats, and I'm going to turn to Mike on this because of your extensive experience looking at the Latino vote in California. Mm-hmm. How were Democrats finally able to do this in the Valadao district, which has long had Democrats overwhelming Republicans in voter registration, but has long had Republican members of Congress representing it?
Look, there's a both sides here are taking either credit or pointing blame, I think, in typical fashion, in ways that are not necessarily accurate. There is no question that the main driver of what was going on was Donald Trump, okay? The anti-sentiment towards the Republican brand generally and Donald Trump specifically, I don't think can be overemphasized. To say that this size of a wave was generated through tactical applications alone is just, it's just not accurate. There's no evidence for that. There, I will say this, though. And in this seat, the fascinating thing about the Valadao seat is you weren't seeing the same amount of money poured into these districts as you were in the Orange County seats.
Democrats came off of TV and then went back on just at the very end when it looked like they must have seen something, seen them having a shot or just had extra money lying around.
And they probably had both, which is fair, and that's fine, and that was a good tactical move. But there was no long sustained spend in that race that was signifying that they were going to actually mount a significant challenge towards it. They were seeing that late break. They invested and doubled down on that late break. It was a smart one. But to suggest that somehow there was some tactical element to drive out the Latino vote, I think is simply not true. What's most important is again, somebody who's been looking at this vote for a very long time, this fits a very predictable pattern with the Latino vote, which is it is mobilized and it shows up when the community feels that it's under attack in great numbers. This is the first time we're seeing this huge of an upswing with Latino voters in a midterm in some time, right? Going back to probably late 1990s, early 2000s. And so it again underscores 20 years of looking at this, which is Latinos respond overwhelmingly to negative external attacks on the community. While there was clearly some turnout effects because of the enormous spend that Democrats put into these efforts, the fact that it was happening statewide and not just in targeted areas tells us it was something much bigger than what was happening with some of these on-the-ground efforts.
And Paul, I want to start to zoom out a bit by framing it this way. You had mentioned the 2% typical swing for a Democratic candidate, a 2% gain. But according to Rob Pyers with the California Target Book, every single one of these seven competitive races swung toward the Democratic candidate by at least 2.8%. And the Valadao-Cox race was the largest with a swing of 4%. Second highest was the Mimi Walters-Katie Porter race in Orange County. So, Paul, is this California's new normal?
Well, definitely when we look at the races that had the biggest movement, we're seeing a lot of that happening in areas where you had huge organized ground campaigns. You had efforts on the ground with volunteers and paid canvassers going out and encouraging people to drop their ballots off at the polling place or making sure that they stood in line to fill out a provisional ballot. So you do see a lot of this growth in areas where you had the most active campaigns. But the structural thing underneath it is that we just had so many more voters in this portion of the electorate that is late returned absentee ballots and provisional ballots and also the new state's same-day voter registration. Those same-day voter registrations aren't even looked at until they've processed all the other ballots and they need to make sure that these voters are eligible and that they didn't vote somewhere else. So we're going to see that actually grow in 2020 because we're going to see more counties going to all-mail elections, including LA County, that's going to go to a modified version of this vote center model. And we're going to see a larger voter file. We're going to see our voter file grow from 20 million now to about 22 million. And we know historically that those new registrants are more likely to select to be vote by mail, about 2/3 of them. So this combination of effects means that in the 2020 primary in general, we're going to see more and more people in that bucket of the late absentees. And it's important to know that in California elections, and we've talked about this, but in California elections, not only do we have Democrats and Republicans and Latinos and Asians and white voters and all these other mathematical ways that you can break out the electorate and determine strategies, we now in California have a time function. You know, California is the only state where you can, you know, in this election, you could have voted on October 8th and not know who won until December 8th. And in that 60-day period, we have different voters who are, you know, the first weekend returning their ballots. Those are older, more conservative, whiter, more homeowner voters. The voters who are getting their absentee ballots mailed to the wrong address, maybe their parents' house, and then having to show up to a polling place and get a new ballot. We have voters who are mailing it on the very last day, on that Tuesday before the election. And we have all these voters who, as we talked about really soon after the election night, all these voters that were lining up at vote centers on college campuses to register there locally and then vote. And this time function is really important. And we saw actually in the late ballots in 2016, this last section of ballots that are being counted right now, 45% of them were 18 to 34-year-olds. So the vast majority of these ballots that are being counted late are from not as much about Democrat versus Republican, but mostly about young versus old, that these late ballots skew extremely old, extremely young. And that lends to this shifting, and that shifting is going to grow as the vote by mail becomes a bigger part of our election system. In that last bucket, these voters who are, you know, dropping off their absentee ballot at the polling place, or showing up at the wrong polling place and having to fill out a provisional ballot, or registering same day, these voters are younger. And as we've seen in California, that is also a base of the Democratic vote. These younger, millennial voters who are renters, not homeowners, who are in college, that's more of a Democratic base. And that's a reason why, as we get to these late results, we see, you know, big shifts in the overall results as these late ballots are getting counted. It's because the pool from which we're counting these ballots is a much more progressive-leaning pool.
All right. Should we talk about ballot harvesting? Should we define ballot harvesting?
Ballot harvesting is ballot delivery. Ballot harvesting is a funny term, and it's going to probably stay with us.
Is it spin?
Well, it kind of sounds like you're going out into the fields and, like, you know, planting voters and then waiting for them to grow and harvest them. It's not really exactly. It's a little bit more benign. It's returning your ballot. If Mike Madrid and I are roommates, which we were briefly once, and he said, "Hey, Paul."
I carried his ballots to the polling place a couple of times back then, too.
That was illegal under the old law.
It was illegal under the old law.
No, if you shared a home with someone, you could.
Is that right?
I thought it was family member.
Family member or housemate. So apparently you guys could have done that. Yeah. You were in jest, but you could have done so. Now, whether it would have still, you know, still maintained, you know, a Democratic voter mysteriously would have been
Yeah, I think
switched.
our vote
we cancel each other out. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, the way the law, as I understand it, works is in the past, if you couldn't return your vote by mail ballot yourself, either by mail or in person, only a relative or someone living in the same household could do it for you. But under a new state law signed a couple of years ago, now anyone can do that, even a paid campaign staffer or, say, someone working for a labor union or for an advocacy group or volunteers or your neighbor who is just volunteering and walking up to your house and saying, hey, can I get you to fill this out? Hey, can I get you to take it back with you? So, Mike, are there opportunities for fraud, or might a voter be willing to hand their ballot over, not to be filled out by someone, but to have it be delivered?
Well, look, if the question is, are there opportunities for fraud? Of course there are. I mean, that's undeniable. Is it happening? I don't think so. I don't think, and certainly not in any meaningful way. I think that this is another reform that is trying to accommodate the social changes in people's lives and engage as many voters as possible. And I think that's a good thing. I don't think it's anything to be feared. I do think, though, that there is something a little bit problematic about the way our civic engagement, civic involvement is changing. And I don't believe that we should be having everybody go to the polls on the first Tuesday of whatever month it is that we're deciding to have our elections. And I'm also really not concerned about what the tactical outcomes of this are going to be. And what I mean by that is, as I have come under a lot of criticism since the election, saying the Republican Party is basically dead in the state.
You're one of several prominent Republicans in California who are saying that, including some current and former state lawmakers.
Yeah, and there's been a really strong pushback to that from both sides of the aisle. But I think those people don't understand what's happening, the size and scope of what is happening socially here. I don't believe that ballot harvesting was an attempt to accommodate partisan gain, or if it was, I don't think that will be the long-term effects of what is going on. I think that it's simply going to be a way to get and engage more voters into the process. So while I think that we need to be vigilant in ensuring the integrity of our ballots, I think it's equally important that we work to ensure the greatest participation possible.
So, Paul, the Republican blame game in California and Washington is well underway. GOP strategist Dave Gilliard, who advised Jeff Denham, Mimi Walters, Young Kim, Diane Harkey, has blamed Trump. Sean Steele, California's Republican National Committeeman, has blamed everything but Trump. Congressman Dana Rohrabacher blamed Bolshevik billionaires. And Congressman Jeff Denham blames the voting process. Here he is on MSNBC last week.
Statistically impossible to have six seats that won all the early voting, including Election Day, to see the provisionals, the set-aside ballots, come in after the fact. And in this case, the 21st District, 2 weeks late. I mean, the question needs to be not only to the Republican Party in California on the rules, but I think the state as a whole needs to look at the provisional ballots.
The 21st District being Valadao's, not Denham's. Denham's was resolved, I want to say, within a week or so of Election Day. But Paul, statistically impossible?
Absolutely not. We see very different populations being counted in these different buckets. And these late voters, as we've talked about, are going to be more progressive. And the inverse is so true. When we looked at the early vote, when we had our early Keys to the House podcasts and we were watching those early votes come in, we were remarking at that seniors, as an example, in the first 2 weeks of voting, seniors were half of the ballots that were being returned. And so if somebody's on one hand going to say this late progressive surge is somehow statistically impossible, then it would hold true that that early conservative surge is statistically impossible. And it's definitely not. We definitely see different patterns in this new time function of California elections. And campaigns know this. Campaigns know that, you know, in the data, we have flags for people who always vote early. And they know to mail those people, phone bank those people, and persuade those people early. And there's other voters who always vote at the polling place or always drop off their mail ballots on the last day, and they know to target them late. So to come in a month after the election and say, oh my gosh, you know, this, we never even heard of this, and this is something that's statistically impossible, is, you know, just, I think, not honest evaluation of what happened in this election. And then in with regard to the ballot harvesting, as Mike was talking about, and I hate agreeing with Mike.
Tough,
just,
I know.
It's been hard. But they're calling it ballot harvesting. It really is just about ballot delivery. Like Mike said, it is being claimed that it's to the advantage of Democrats right now. But in the long term, I don't think it's going to be to either party's tactical advantage because both parties will start accommodating this. The first instances of how this was being done was in special elections in 2007, particularly in the 34th Congressional District race, where one of the candidates was having voters come to church and drop off their ballots at church so that they could be turned in. And that doesn't seem to me to be some kind of a nefarious practice. It seems to me to be a way to accommodate more voters in this new system we're having where more people are voting by mail. And we want to try to reduce the hurdles for people to be able to get their ballots back in. And there have been claims, and Paul Ryan was one of them, where he said these late votes are a function of ballot harvesting.
Well, we have Paul Ryan on tape speaking with the Washington Post. So let's play that now.
In California, it just defies logic to me. We had a lot of wins that night. We were only down 26 seats the night of the election. And 3 weeks later, we lost basically every contested California race. This election system they have, I can't begin to understand what ballot harvesting is. But so I think California.
Do you think there's something wrong with it?
No, I just think it's weird. I mean, okay. In Wisconsin, you know, we knew like the next day. You know, Scott Walker, my friend, I was sad to see him lose, but we accepted the results on Wednesday.
What he's doing it in a way is he's conflating this idea and this ballot delivery system that they're calling ballot harvesting with these changes of votes as we get later into the process. But the fact is that when you do receive a ballot and turn it back in, you have to turn it back in within 3 days. You can't just like hold on to it. It doesn't become part of this late ballots. It is part of the ballots that are turned in, you know, day by day in the month before the election. And they're part of the early vote that's counted, not the late vote. So that's one thing to kind of make sure to unpack is that these are two different things. And then, you know, the fact that in 2016, these provisional voters and late voters were 45% aged 18 to 34, that just screams out why these late results are so different than the early results.
Yeah, let me speak to that a little bit, because again, I'm trying to find a place where Paul and I disagree, and I think maybe I found a little bit here.
Should have brought you in before the election.
The biggest question here in my mind, or the biggest way to explain why Republicans are behaving this way, is because they are literally only speaking to one demographic right now in California. It is the fastest shrinking demographic, and that is non-college educated white rural voters. There's only so much harvesting you can do with a demographic before you're running out of runway here. And what they've done is basically seeded every other growth group, specifically and particularly young people and people of color, who are making up a disproportionate amount of those lates and provisional and even day of voters. So the Republicans have basically painted themselves in a corner with nowhere to go. And so every explanation they can look at, except for acknowledging that fact, is what they're going to come up with and articulate. And I think that more than anything is goes to explain why there are so many Republican leaders and elected officials who are acknowledging every crazy scenario out there except for the obvious.
It wasn't Trump on his own. Trump was accelerating some of the trends that California Republicans were facing, yeah. Right?
Yeah. And like I believe that this was an extinction event. It's been on a downslide for 20 years.
Paul is laughing right now.
It's been heading this way for two decades. The fact that you had Donald Trump and then you had John Cox, the gubernatorial candidate, literally trying to emulate Donald Trump, right?
When he hadn't even voted for him in 2016. He voted for the Libertarian
and
for president.
That's what's so frightening about the party and where it has this point that it's gotten to is John Cox didn't vote for Donald Trump. He opposed a wall before he announced – you know, he was running for governor. Then he changes to say, I support a wall, and makes that one of his main campaign thematics. And suddenly this guy who was trying to position as a Jack Kemp style Republican is now setting the right flank and really what is a nationalist race baited campaign. And that's what is problematic with the party. When you're only speaking to the fastest shrinking demographic in the state, why are you surprised when that's all the vote that you're getting?
And yet, John Cox outperformed in Orange County the congressional vote, as did yes on Proposition 6 to repeal the gas tax. Both lost statewide, but they did outperform congressional vote counts.
That's such a silly argument. That's like saying we are slightly less worse than the worst outcome in 100 years. That's not an argument. That literally tells us nothing. It's really more sad than anything else. But that's where the Republican Party is. Until there's a wholesale reassessment demographically of what it is doing, it's going to continue on this 20-year slide. And so it's true. Trump didn't cause this, but he certainly put a megaphone to it. And all of the candidates that emulated that strategy not only brought themselves down, but they were bringing other non-Trump-style Republicans down with them.
And Paul, you're itching to get in here.
Well, no. I mean, first off, the reason I'm laughing is Mike is just such a quote machine. and what I'm seeing here, so many people in California and nationally talk about this arc that California's been on since Prop 187 and the Pete Wilson administration and the change and then looking at what's happening nationally, and for me, having known Mike since the Pete Wilson administration, it's like Mike is an embodiment of this. And the hearing him talk about this and watching him, you know, kind of this consternation about where the Republican Party is, I'm not just hearing it like for the first time. I've been hearing this since the mid-90s when this consternation was just a little tiny sprout, but now it has blossomed. It is a forest over here across the desk from me.
Look at your metaphors now.
I'm trying. But it is amazing. I mean, Mike has had this kind of struggle with a element of what was happening in his own party in the 90s, and it was an element. It was like
a fringe.
It was a fringe. It was a portion of the electorate and a portion of the messaging that I think led Mike to evaluate his own party, led Mike to evaluate voter coalitions, led Mike to write a thesis at Georgetown on this segment of the population and on messaging and on kind of what it meant to be a Republican. And now, you know, 20 years later, it's like the blinding portion of what's happening in his party.
I want to wrap up by quoting John F. Kennedy. Victory has 1,000 fathers. Defeat is an orphan. Democrats are saying, look, everything we did over the last 2 years is the reason that we've won. You know, we staffed up in Orange County early. We got involved in the primaries, picking candidates ahead of time, trying to avoid Democrats getting shut out under California's top two primary system of the general election in some of these districts. They convinced T.J. Cox to drop out of the Jeff Denham district race and run against David Valadao instead. They did invest a lot of money in get out the vote efforts. Mostly a lot of local groups did that too. Can Democrats rightfully claim that they're responsible for this, or did they just ride the wave? Let's go with Paul.
Well, first off, I do believe campaigns matter. I do believe money matters. Although if this amount of money had come into California in 2014, it would have hit with a thud. It wouldn't have had this impact. God bless every volunteer that came out and walked on the Democratic or Republican side. All of these things matter in campaigns. But if you want a counterargument to that, look at the 4th Board of Equalization seat in Southern California.
Wait. Does anyone listening know what the Board of Equalization still does?
But this is a case where when you have these wave elections, you have weird outcomes. And a sitting state senator, Joel Anderson, who's a Republican, was running for this Board of Equalization seat against a virtual nobody. And this guy just beat Joel Anderson. He had no qualifications other than he had a D next to his name. And so if you'd use that as kind of the test case and you say, if Democrats had done nothing, like they did nothing here, and all we had was this underlying moment, this cultural, political moment, and, you know, real dissatisfaction with both Trump and Congress and a highly engaged and elevated and angry electorate, what would happen? This is the example. And the Democrat won with no campaign.
But you could argue that that's because the get out the vote efforts for the congressional races in those counties but boosted the Democratic turnout. And then they did vote
races,
straight party line.
But it was just the northern consent. There was not that much overlap with the BOE seat, the Board of Equalization seat, the
Orange County and San Diego County,
look,
amongst others.
But
one district in San
the
Diego
The same
County.
Democratic consultants that are gloating right now about what a fantastic job they did are the same ones that were crying in their beer 18 months ago about what a horrible job that they did during the Hillary Clinton campaign. And what Paul is saying is exactly right. There are larger tectonic factors at play. And it's great that you did a wonderful GOTV operation, and it's wonderful that you knocked on each high propensity Democrat's door 150 times. The truth of the matter is this election was overwhelmingly about the rejection of Donald Trump. And I say rejection for a reason. 5 of our last 7 national elections have essentially been change elections. So anybody who believes that this election is somehow a mandate for the Democrats is not looking honestly at our recent history, like our last 10, 15 years. The voters of this country, and I would even argue Orange County, if you look at the data specifically, are voting in it to check the party in power. They're voting against candidates and against parties more than they are voting for them. And so congratulations to Democrats on this last Tuesday's elections in November. They were the same ones that were rejected soundly 2 years before that. And if history is a guide, if they are planning on sealing victories across the country, they're probably not going to do as well as they think they're going to.
20 seconds or less from each of you. Do Republicans have a shot at recapturing the races they lost this year in 2020? Paul.
Well, if I was a Republican consultant, the thing that would terrify me is that this impact of these elections, these 7 flips, 9 legislative district flips, happened in a 64% turnout election. And in the presidential election in 2020, we're going to see 78%, 75%. So take this 64% of the electorate and imagine what the next 12 to 13% add-on to that will be. it is not going to be gray-haired women from Orange County, homeowner Republicans. It's going to be younger renter minorities and college students. And so if you're to take today's election results from this election cycle and make it, you know, 12-15% more progressive, then I don't think you can win back these seats. Another added element to this is the timeline. The filing deadline for these seats is going to be December 6, 2019. These campaigns have a year to ramp up as opposed to a couple years. And we're going to have absentee ballots.
California has an earlier primary because the presidential race, they moved the primary up to March.
So we're going to have absentee ballots dropping in 14 months. And we don't even know which Republicans would be running for any of these seats, if people are going to be running for their old seats, or if they're going to start recruiting new candidates, if they're going to have active primaries. They're very much behind the eight ball because of the time that they have until the next election being compressed.
And Mike, quickly, do Republicans have a shot at recapturing some of the seats they lost in 2020?
Well, there's always a shot. I think it's highly unlikely. You're probably looking at maybe one or two seats. But the bigger point is this, which we're missing, is we're talking about Republicans trying to recapture seats in Orange County. Okay? I mean, that to tell you how significantly, to Paul's point, demographically things have changed and are continuing to change. We've kind of demographically hit that point where we're seeing exponential growth of these non-traditional, which are now traditional communities in California. Extremely hard to see how Republicans get back into relevance in the next generation, probably too, in California.
That's Republican political consultant Mike Madrid. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Paul Mitchell with Political Data Incorporated. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you. I'm glad we survived this.
One final note from that data run by Rob Pyers at the California Target Book. It is fascinating to look at the raw vote counts now compared to what they were in each of these congressional districts at the end of election night, because you see just how many ballots still needed to be counted and just how incomplete that end of election night total was. For example, in the 10th congressional district race between Jeff Denham and Josh Harder, the ballots counted in time for the district's last election night update made up 32% of registered voters. Right now, turnout stands at more than 63%. That's double. Or, put another way, only half the votes had been counted by the end of election night. California is moving to a new election system in which every voter will get a ballot in the mail. So this truly is California's new normal. Well, that is a wrap, not just for this episode, but for our entire podcast. We are so grateful that you've joined us throughout the year. Even though the election is over, PolitiFact California's fact checks aren't going anywhere. You'll find our old and new ones at politifact.com/California, and you can keep up with the new Democratic Congress and the Republican Senate and President Trump by subscribing to the NPR Politics podcast, and of course, by listening to your favorite NPR station. It's Cap Radio, right? Right. So here in California, we are about to enter a new era. Jerry Brown is terming out of the governor's office, and Gavin Newsom will lead the state that on its own makes up the world's fifth largest economy. For full coverage of this transition and a look back at Brown's time in office, we hope you'll consider checking out our stories that run on NPR stations throughout California and at capradio.org. And join Cap Radio live on Monday, January 7th, as the governor-elect takes the oath of office. Our podcast is produced by Sally Schilling and edited by Nick Miller. Our intern is Gabriela Fernandez. Chris Hagen is our digital editor. The executive producer is Linnea Edmeyer. Keys to the House was created by Ben Bradford, and his brother Matt Bradford composed and performed our theme music. I'm Ben Adler, and this is Keys to the House from Capital Public Radio.